like the Most High.
Alexander Gurr's Turmmusik, or Tower Music, given its world premiere in Manchester recently by Nigel Robson, the BBC Philharmonic, and conductor H.K. Gruber. Sandy, for a long time you've taught, and I wonder how now, as you're still writing but no longer teaching, how you feel about the composition scene or the new music scene?
I must say, about composition, especially composition in this country, that the standard and quality of writing, I can never remember it as high as it is now. Certainly wasn't as high in my generation. I mean, people write very, very well indeed, and technically they're very good. But that compliment has a slight sting in its tail, or a Parthian shot, one might say, at this point in the programme. The main difference is between my age group and theirs, if I assume that most of them are younger than I am, is that I'm not sure that I detect exactly what they have to say. We were more concerned with what we had to say than how we said it, and consequently we were often not so realistic and not that interested in technique. Now I find that people are terribly good. I can't fault them. But I don't know what they're saying, if they're saying anything, or whether they're just creating a kind of Baroque without Bach. I suppose that's my feeling, but it's very much based on lack of information. One of the things is that one gets slightly out of touch. There seem to be so many composers that even identifying them is quite difficult.
So why do you write music?
Got nothing else to do. Because I'd be bored if I were not writing music. I can't see any other purpose in being alive.
Sandy Gurr, thank you very much.
Here and Now was presented by Sarah Moore-Peach. Alexander Gurr's Tower Music is a BBC Radio 3 commission. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 3 minutes past midnight, time for the early music show. And Lucy Skeeping looks at the background to an infamous 18th century French pamphlet war, the Querelle des Bouffons, sparked by a comic operatic diversion by the Italian composer Pergolesi.
On the first day of August 1752, a two-act intermezzo, a short comic opera, if you like, was performed in Paris. Its title was La Serva Padrona. The composer was Giovanni Battista Pergolesi, and the performers, just a soprano and a bass, plus a handful of instrumentalists, were an itinerant troupe of Italian players. Nothing particularly unusual about that, you might think, just another evening out for opera lovers. But you'd be wrong. This little piece, lasting less than 40 minutes, in fact sparked a fierce controversy, an almighty war of words between supporters of two different kinds of music theatre. It brought in philosophers, writers, musicians and kings. It threw up differences between national styles and cultures and social hierarchies, and it was even seen as a proxy for the larger political arguments of the day. And all this became what history now calls La Querelle des Bouffons, or the Quarrel of the Comedians.
Stupendo, mi stupendo. parlare. Servire, vuol così, vuol così, servire, vuol così. Credio che mi intendete, che mi intendete, che mi intendete, da chi mi conosce, sto molti e molti di.
Katalin Forkos singing Serpina's aria Stizzoso mio stizzoso from Pergolesi's La serva padrona. Written in 1733, when Pergolesi was barely 23 years old, La serva padrona, or the servant turned mistress of the house, wasn't really a full-on opera, more of a comic interlude. As its title suggests, it's about a saucy servant girl, Serpina, who uses her wiles to lure her gullible master into marrying her so that she becomes the padrona. Standard commedia dell'arte, you might say, but almost 20 years later, La serva padrona became very famous indeed, celebrated by some and reviled by others. The work had first been given in Paris in 1746. Back then, it had hardly been noticed. The venue was the Italian Theatre, and the audience was unsophisticated and fairly easy to please. 6 years later, though, the company returned to France, and this time their venue was the illustrious Royal Academy of Music in the great theatre of the Palais Royal. Now, nothing less than an intellectual storm erupted that filled the columns of newspapers and became the subject of hundreds of pamphlets. So just why was there so much fuss? Well, one way of answering simply to look at what else was on that season at the Palais Royal. Overshadowing Pergolesi's short piece in the double bill was a revival of Acis and Galatea, the final masterpiece of that much revered composer Jean-Baptiste Lully. Lully had been dead for almost 60 years by this time, but nevertheless his kind of opera, the tragédie en musique, remained the very backbone of French music theatre. As tradition dictated, it took for its subjects kings, heroes and gods. In this aria from Acis, Lully's Apollo descends from the heavens, ostensibly addressing the characters on stage, but in effect simply flattering his patron, Louis XIV. On this day, Apollo approves your zeal for a charming prince, sings the sun god. I always take care to please the greatest of heroes. The whole universe pays him their respects.
Thank you.
Howard Crook there as Apollo singing an aria from Lully's Acis and Galatea. Tragedy lyrique, or tragedy en musique, Lully style, with its classical gods and mythical heroes, was the very antithesis of Pere Gallese's little farce. One featured grand, elevated French sentiments of utmost seriousness and tradition, designed to celebrate the victory of good over evil, and the other was full of earthy characters who played out the juicy little plot to a rollicking series of singable folk-style tunes. In short, it was the virtuous, absolutist French monarchy versus the triumph of a sexy serving wench. Just 30 years later, another serving girl, Beaumarchais's Susanna, would make her provocative appearance on stage on the eve of a revolution that was to abolish the French monarchy and all it had stood for centuries. Pere Gallese's Serva Padrona may not have been quite in the same class as The Marriage of Figaro, but it likewise turned the social tables, with the servant girl, Sapina's gullible master, Uberto, marrying her by the end of the piece.
Senti, tapata, tapata, tapata. Ma questo che se può, ma che se può,
io non so,
io non so.
Ma
caro, caro, gioia, 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 gioia.
Il mar-
battene il cuore con un da puro amore e batte forte un giorno e batte forte un giorno e batte forte un giorno e batte forte un giorno. Senti, tapatà, tapatà, tapatà.
Oh, è vero, è sento già.
Ma questo che ser può? A che ser può? A che ser può?
Io non lo so.
Non so io.
Cara sposa.
Cara sposa. Oddio. Ben te lo puoi pensare. Ben te lo puoi pensare, sì, ben te lo puoi pensare, ben te lo puoi pensare.
Mi percuote,
che?
Le morte mi chiamo.
Ma questo che ser può?
Io non lo so.
Ma questo che ser può?
Io non lo so. Senti, senti.
Senti, senti, tapatà, tapatà, tapatà.
Oh,
ma questo che ser può? Ma che ser può?
Io non so.
Io non so.
Ma cara, cara,
gioia, 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 gioia.
For you in my heart, love's little hammer is beating away. Knock, knock, can you hear it? The final duet from Pergolesi's La Serva Padrona with Maddalena Bonifacio as the serving girl Serpina and Sigmund Nimsgern as Uberto. Not, you might think, the stuff of revolution, but for those involved, the great argument, La Querelle des Bouffons, was a pretty heated affair. On the surface, the argument debated the respective merits of Italian and French music, especially opera. In a celebrated letter to one of the Parisian newspapers of the day, now known as the Letter of Omphouli, one of the city's leading intellectuals, Friedrich Melchior Grimm, complained of yet another reappearance on the French stage of a so-called masterpiece in the French operatic tradition, the opera Omphouli, which had been composed for Versailles at the end of the 17th century by André de Touche. In my opinion, wrote Grimm, this music is from one end to the other in bad taste and full of contradictions, lugubrious, without any expressiveness, and always inappropriate to its subject, which is the worst fault of all. The composer is dead, and his work had little enough life in the first place. Actually, Grimm wasn't only trashing the old French operas of people like de Touche and Lully. He was also criticising the works of the contemporary establishment figure Jean-Philippe Rameau, who, in his own compositions, continued to favour the style of the old tragédie en lyrique.
Thank you.
Castor and Pollux, a tragedy en musique by Rameau, with Lézard Florissant, first performed in 1737. So let's look a little closer at the background to the quarrel of the comedians. For all the proud nationalism of French intellectual life, the mid-18th century was also the era of the Enlightenment, the time when Diderot and his friends, the encyclopedists, began to lay down in a cool and rational way all the knowledge about the arts and sciences that the wider world had by then accumulated. So perhaps it's significant that some of the most outspoken supporters of Italian opera were in fact foreign-born. It wasn't long before German-born Friedrich Grimm produced another pamphlet trashing the old French opera style, this time written rather ingeniously, as if from the pen of an ancient biblical prophet. Aiming his thunderbolts at the erring people of France, Grimm praised Pergolesi, who he wrote would banish from French opera the tediousness which prevents me from attending, and consecrate it like that of the Italians. "I shall teach your poets to write texts and your musicians to write music," roared the fictional prophet, "so that people will no more call that which is monotonous beautiful." Others soon joined the fray. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the famous philosopher of education and of nature and the noble savage, he wasn't the sort of man to soothe souls, even those in a position to butter his meagre bread, and he now used his celebrity status to join the anti-French faction, lashing out in the press in particular at Rameau, against whom he had a personal grudge anyway. Part of the problem, Rousseau wrote, was the French language, which he felt was far less singable than Italian. "There is neither measure nor melody in French music," he thundered, "because the language is not capable of them. French singing is a continual squalling, its harmony crude and devoid of expression." As it happened, Rousseau was also a skilled musician, and so he was able to offer something of a solution. His own light operatic comedy, Le Devin du Village, or The Village Soothsayer, which appeared right in the midst of the quarrel of the comedians. There were no gods in the opera, no mythical heroes, no great paeans to the King of France, just the love lives of ordinary people in a story of a gentleman's attempts to seduce a country girl. "I have lost all my happiness. I have lost my beloved," sings little Colette. "What a silly shepherdess I am."
Thank you.
opening aria from Rousseau's Le Devin du Village. Deliberately inspired by La Serva Padrona, it tells of Colin, or Colin, who has grown weary of his life of luxury and returns to his simple country life with the shepherdess Colette. For Rousseau, the freer, honest life of the country, set amidst the fruits and joys of nature, was the true inheritance of mankind. In the town, there's more hustle and bustle, but are they happy amid such frolicking fun? We're always content, always singing, natural beauty, unadorned, pure, artless pleasure. Do their concerts measure up to our musettes? That's what the characters in the final scene of the opera sing. No gods and no kings here. This was a subject to reflect the spirit of enlightened times.
Thank you.
An aria from Rousseau's Le Devin du Village. It was all about as far from the cosseted formality of the royal court as you could get. And yet, ironically, when the king first heard it, he was enchanted. Rousseau, however, being a quirky character, was in fact his own worst enemy. Instead of kowtowing, on the first night of the opera, he turned up unshaven and with his wig unkempt, even though Louis XV was to attend. Next day, he was invited to meet the king, but was so flustered and worried about saying or doing the wrong thing that he fled the town instead, thereby forfeiting the life pension that was dangling before him. When the news got round, the public were appalled by Rousseau's unconventional behaviour. He lost his pass to the Paris Opera and was allegedly abused and kicked when he tried to enter the building. Members of the orchestra even burnt an effigy of him. So, what about the pro-French faction? Well, Rousseau and Grimm and their allies certainly didn't make all the running in the Querelle des Bouffons. Indeed, traditional French opera had its own stout defenders. In 1753, the year after Père Galaise's controversial comedy appeared in Paris, Jean-Joseph de Mondonville produced an opera called Titon et l'Aurore. This was very much an old-fashioned French pastoral, full of the usual suspects, the gods and goddesses, classical figures and so on. And it was a huge success, not least because just about all the seats in the Palais Royal Theatre were bagged by pro-French supporters, keen to make their point as loudly as possible. The opposite faction, the partisans of Italian opera, were furious to find their seats occupied by members of the French Royal Guard, by members of the Household Cavalry and the King's own musketeers. It's hard to judge through the fog of history and battle the actual quality of the production that evening, but certainly the audience must have been impressed by the opening prologue with its orchestral sinfonia, depicting the moment the statues in Prometheus's palace are brought to life, and by Prometheus's great exultation and defiance of Zeus, and his declaration of love for the human race. One commentator enthusiastically compared the work's uplifting theme with what he saw as the trivialities of Père Galaise's work. "The chorus of animated statues," he wrote, "expresses the philosophical terror which each man must feel when he contemplates himself, addressing himself to heaven in his wish to understand his plight and his own existence. These are the tableau which our operas should present instead of depicting a man's impatience as he waits for his drink of chocolate." Here's the first scene in which Prometheus brings the statues to life. "Open your eyes," he tells them, "know yourselves."
Dieu ne connaît felicite, une éternelle indifférence. Dieu, Dieu, ne connaissez-vous d'autre félicité, une éternelle votre haute oisiveté, déshonore votre puissance. Dieu, Dieu, ne connaissez-vous d'autre félicité, une éternelle
faire le plus parfait ouvrage. Ouvrez les yeux,
the opening scene from Mondonville's Titon et l'Aurore, Philippe Huttenlocher with Les Musiciens du Louvre, directed by Mark Minkowski. So what in the end was the outcome of the quarrel of the comedians? Well, it rumbled on for a couple of years or so. The pamphlet war eventually subsided. The Italian operatic troupe who'd performed the Pergolesi comedy returned home to Italy, and a kind of normal service was resumed. But the quarrel did leave an indelible mark. In fact, just 25 years later, the operatic Cognoscenti, passionate and stubborn as ever, launched another dispute, this time between the respective merits of the latest works of Gluck and those of his alleged rival, Piccini. Gradually, Italian, or at least Italian-style, opera began to triumph over the tragédie lyrique of Rameau and his successors, as composers such as Salieri and the young Cherubini introduced new works into Paris. So did the pro-Italians win then? Well, that would be too simplistic, but it is appropriate, I think, to end a programme about the notorious Corel with music from another work, Antoine Duverne's Les Troquets. Literally, it translates as The Barterers. This half-hour musical comedy was a kind of embryonic Così fan tutti. It was given in Paris in 1753, just a year after Pergolesi's La Serva Padrona, and not only is it clearly in its debt, but we can also hear some of the first stirrings of what would later develop into the French comic operatic style of Offenbach and others in the following century. Here's the aria Sans Nonchalance, performed by Nicolas Rivon and Capella Coloniensis, directed by William Christie.
J'ai cru faire un bon coup en changeant de figure. Margot était mon fait, peste soit du marché. Avec Fanchon, hélas, il faudra donc conclure. Qui, moi, gardez Fanchon? Qui, moi, gardez Fanchon? J'en serais bien fâché. Chalance, saremo tourment, saremo tourment, une heure, elle balance, une heure, elle balance, pour dire froidement. Que j'en perds patience, que j'en perds patience.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3 Through the Night with me, Jonathan Swain, and a concert now from the archives of the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra Amsterdam. To come here, Beethoven's C major mass, conducted by Sir Colin Davis, First of all, from the 1987 Holland Festival, Leonard Bernstein conducting the players in Schubert's Fifth Symphony. A teenage Schubert here, 19 to be exact, this Fifth Symphony written in 1816, and like the other teenage Schubert symphonies, intended mainly for private or semi-private music making, this Fifth, for a gathering where Schubert himself played the viola and his brother Ferdinand the violin. It's the most lightly scored of all the Schubert symphonies, and it is a pearl of very great price.
Thank you.